Good morning. Good afternoon. I'm used to morning sessions. We have three bills on our agenda today. We're going to start with House Bill 2272A. This is a bill that conforms the Energy Conservation Facility Tax Credit eligibility criteria, the criteria used by the Office of Energy and Certifying Facilities. So it's a conformity bill. Mr. Waters, who's our conformity bill guru today. Welcome. Good afternoon.
I'll start it out as a conformist.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
He looks like a non-conformist to me.
What was your comment, Senator Corcoran, about that? An extroverted economist is the one that stares at your shoes while he speaks.
Okay. House Bill 2272A is our general reconnect bill this session. What it does is it establishes December 31, 2000 as the connection date to the Internal Revenue Code for various definitions and references to the Internal Revenue Code in Oregon statutes. Note that connection to general changes in the definition of taxable income are adopted continuously under Rolling Reconnect, which was enacted in 1997, as some of you will recall. And that is not affected by provisions of this particular bill. That happens automatically. But this bill also does a few other things. It reconciles some conflicting language in two Oregon statutes regarding the Business Energy Tax Credit Program. It corrects some tax administration provisions regarding innocent spouse protection and safe harbor rules or estimated tax payments. It revises the factors used to make inflation adjustments in ORS Chapter 316, especially relating to the personal income tax brackets and the personal exemption credit. And this particular provision is where the revenue impact in your revenue impact statement originates. In addition, the bill makes some other technical changes. I believe we have Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue who is here to enlighten us on the technical aspects of the bill. And
Chair Ferriola, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. What you are receiving is a summary of the various sections of the bill. I'd be more than happy to go through that if you would like me to do so, or to take particular items that might interest you. But on the first page of the summary, Ed touched on some of the provisions in the bill, and I'll just go through this list, again, reconciling some conflicts in the business energy tax credit statute. There's a clarification that when a person files an amended return and they have an extension, that amended return is the return that they use to figure out their estimated tax payments under the prior tax safe harbor, the innocent spouse provisions that Ed discussed. There's a conformity for Measure 88, which raises the federal tax deduction to $5,000. Updating income thresholds for determining when residents are required to file a return. There is a change to the appeal period following a federal appeal. That's moved from 60 to 90 days to conform with other appeal periods, so there's not confusion among taxpayers about what their appeal period is. A technical clarification related to 99 legislation and the claim of right credit. Another technical correction that allows the department to refund overpayments when a return is filed and payments come in after the return is filed. There's a provision relating to estimated tax for corporations and how we calculate interest on underpayments. And then repealing an obsolete statute related to medical savings accounts.
Questions, Senator? No, thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have some amendments which you should have in front of you dash eight twos and dash eight threes. The dash eight twos update internal revenue code connection dates for two income tax credit programs, which were recently changed or expanded by federal tax reform bill, House Resolution 1836, which passed just before Memorial Day in Washington, D.C. Those two credits, which it references, are the earned income credit and the adoption credit. In both cases, it expands eligibility for those credits and also the credit amounts. And by tying to the more recent connection date or definition date, it would make tax administration easier and make also compliance for tax filers easier. The Dash A3 amendments are conflict amendments, which are necessary to reconcile conflict with Senate Bill 521. Senate Bill 521, I believe, passed this committee, and I believe passed the House side as well. So that is close to being signed into law if it hasn't been.
So the reconnection would require the A2 and A3 amendments to be adopted. So we would eliminate conflicts and reconcile the bill with the legislation that we previously passed.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The dash A3s are necessary conflict amendments. Dash A2s are desirable to update to more recent definitions regarding the earned income credit and the federal adoption credit.
Ed, there would be a general fund revenue impact that's derived through reconnection. Perhaps you'd like to discuss that just briefly with the committee.
Mr. Chair, the revenue impact statement in front of you for the A and gross version of the bill shows a positive $23.4 million impact for the 0103 biennium. This is an estimate based on the change in the indexation factors proposed in the bill. Currently, the tax brackets and the personal exemption credit are indexed for inflation. This bill changes the base, the starting point for that indexation, and also changes the index used for the exemption credit, I believe, from the Oregon City Index to the U.S. CPI, which is a better index. It's more standard. The reason for doing this is that it's a, right now, the way the law is written, it's impossible to predict with certainty what the tax bracket amounts and the exemption credit amounts are going to be until the end of the tax year. The change will allow, will change the basing for those statistics to an earlier period. And so the Department of Revenue can publish with certainty what the actual tax brackets and what the exemption credit amounts will be in advance of the end of the tax year.
Thank you, Ed. Any questions for Mr. Waters on the orientation of this bill? We had a sign-up sheet for public testimony in the bill.
Mr. Chair, we had Deborah Buchanan. Okay.
Thank you. Colleagues, my intention is to go into work session on House Bill 2272A, and we need to move in the dash 12 and 13 amendments. Dash A2 and dash A3 in order to conform previous action on a different bill. So on 12 and 13, that has nothing to do with the bill under consideration. The A2 and A3 amendments are under consideration. Let's go into work session on the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move the dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2272.
The Vice Chair has moved the dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2272. Any questions on the motion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2272.
The Vice Chair moves the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2272. Any questions on the motion? Any objections to the motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Bill
2272A as amended to the floor. If it do pass.
The motion is to move the amended House Bill 2272 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions? Any objections? So ordered, the chair will carry. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2272 and move to House Bill, or Senate Bill 67. Mr. Watts, appreciate your help.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Colleagues, as you know, Senate Bill 67 is a straightforward reduction of capital gains on personal income and corporate income excise tax that applies beginning what tax year, Ed?
Mr. Chair, we have some amendments which change the effective date. As the bill is currently in committee, it has the -3 amendments incorporated. -3 amendments affect capital gains beginning tax year 2003. We also have -6 amendments, which also become effective for tax year 2003, but have a more gradual reduction in the capital gains tax rate over time. Eventually, both -3 and the -6 get to the 4% capital gains rate. -3 get their beginning tax year 2005. The -6 get their beginning tax year 2007.
It would be the chair's intention to move the -3 amendment. Now, we have considered this bill as a referral. Of a 6% rate reduction effective or beginning 2003, 2004, et cetera. We've also seen a couple of other iterations of this bill. The -3 amendments are the ones that you'd like to consider at this point. We have this still scheduled for work session only, but I'll ask if there's any person here present that wishes to offer testimony on the bill. Anything there? We are in work session on Senate Bill 67. Chair would entertain a motion to move Senate Bill 67 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
I'm going to move the -3 amendments first.
You should move the -3 amendments first. Ed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the -3 amendments have already been adopted.
Yeah.
If you want to move it, it's already adopted.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it's adopted. But it's not a referral. It's simply.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's not no referral. Referral amendments are separate.
Yeah. It's our intention to move that bill as it is to the form of the due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move. Senate Bill 67 is amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
The motion is to move the Senate Bill 67 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Questions on the motion? Objections to the motion?
I'll be voting no, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Did you expect otherwise?
There are some questions.
Yeah,
there is. Well, then we'll just close the work session on Senate Bill 67 and move right along then to. The next item on the agenda, which is House Bill 2208, another non-controversial one. Extremely pleasant to say.
And important.
What's and that important. Important one, there? One that has a very interesting relating clause. Welcome. How are you?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2208, A engrossed, we heard this in the last hearing, and I'll just try to recap again what the bill does just to refresh everyone's memory, and then we'll start in with the amendment.
But again, this is a bill that you passed out, I guess it was May 22nd, and then we had to bring it back because of a conflict amendment that needed to be introduced with the bill. So first of all, what the bill is doing, it was brought by Department of Revenue, the various technical changes that they wanted to see. First of all, beginning with local option taxes that are approved in the September election. So this just provides the requirements for local governments when they do have a local option tax approved in September election. Then it's reorganizing some agricultural statutes with no major changes. It's extending the sunset date out 10 years for tribal land under application to replacing U.S. Trust. Another thing it's doing is it's clarifying disclosure issues for the Department of Revenue with their senior deferral program accounts. It provides some administrative technical changes to the Elderly Rental Assistance Program and Nonprofit Elderly Homes Property Tax Exemption Program. It's allowing the Department of Revenue to divide that appropriation between the two programs each year based on the department's best estimate, as well as allow proration then of both program payments. And then finally, the thing that we've been discussing a lot recently is with the elderly, or with the not the senior deferral program and disabled deferral program, increasing that initial household income limit from $27,500 to $32,000. So that's all included in the A and Gross bill that came to you from the House Revenue Committee, and then you also adopted an A-10 on May 22nd, and the A-10 amendment was dealing with that, making the special assessments that also are allowed deferral of property taxes for the special assessments, not just their entire property taxes, but any special assessment charges, making those income limits then consistent with now what we're changing in House Bill 2208. So it moved that limit from 17,500 household limit to 32,000, which is what we are doing in 2208. So that's what we did so far. Then the dash A-12 was the conflict amendment that you had before you. And in the last hearing, you adopted the dash A-12 and the dash A-13. You adopted them into your to House Bill 2208. So with the A-12, again, all that is just dealing with your A-10 that you passed out on May 22nd and then addressing the conflict the council found with the county biennium budget bill. And then with the A-13, that was the amendment that you was dealing with a change in the liquor taxes. And so Dick will address on some issues with that. And then I'll just start in with the A-14. And A-14 we heard in the last hearing. Now that was the one dealing with Representative Witt came and testified with dealing with the war veterans and allowing the war veterans to come on to the property tax deferral program without an income limit. So the A-14, as we had talked about before, had a revenue impact, and originally we had talked about how it was about $1.5 million. But I did go and redo some numbers and looked at that again. So that's some of the things that you have in your packet is dealing with that issue with the war veterans. But and basically then from the dash A-14, we had the A-16, which was just dealing with an issue the Department of Revenue wanted clarified with the war veterans would have a lien that would be exactly like the disabled population that are on the deferral program currently. And so then the A-17 then was just dealing with it, taking the same A-16 but trying to reduce the revenue impact and reduce the fiscal impact by putting the disabled war veterans under the same household income limits of $32,000. So basically with the A-14, 16, and 17, those amendments, at least from what I've been told, is that it's Representative Witt is okay if they're not adopted. If they're, so he doesn't feel strongly that you have to adopt these particular amendments.
So he has in fact withdrawn his amendment.
Yes.
Which ones are those?
Those are the A-14, and then we revised the A14 with A16 and A17.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
So we don't need to adopt the 16s and 17s?
Any questions on the orientation?
Are we in work session?
Well, we had actually,
Mr. Chair.
Finished, no, I think we're in, I'm in public hearing or work session. We're only in work session.
I think we're in work session.
We are in work session on this.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Senator Thorpe?
I move to delete -13 amendments from 2208.
We have a motion on the floor to delete the -13 amendments from 2208. Colleagues, to your motion, Senator Perkins?
That's been the bane of contention here for the last couple of days, apparently.
Who's that?
It has to do with the malt versus the distilled, being able to be sold in the stores.
So we have a motion on the floor, and that is to remove the -A13. The chairman certainly looking to support that amendment removal, but we'll go ahead and ask the committee for it. Oh, we do. Let me go to my script here. Colleagues, I need to, in order to consider your amendment, Senator, I have to ask for a motion to suspend the rules and then a motion to reconsider the motion whereby House Bill 2208 was amended, and then you can make your amendment.
So moted.
We have a motion to suspend the rules to consider the Senator's motion. We'll go ahead and have a roll call vote on the motion to suspend the rules. And just for clarification, does that not have to be a two-thirds?
Unanimous.
It has to be unanimous? No. You said that.
I said
that's unanimous?
Yeah.
Oh, hi, Dick. Clerk will call the roll.
The anonymous unanimous.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
No.
Unanimous, right?
Yeah. So the motion to suspend the rules failed. So, we are in work session on House Bill 2208.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Vice Chair.
Before we move, I have a question. I have a letter that I frankly haven't had much time to look at from, I guess it's the Senior Health Services, that questions one of the amendments I just want to make sure that we didn't make a mistake. They raised the issue.
Mr. Chairman, Mr.
Vice Chair. Please explain the issue of a potential conflict that was raised by Human Services.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I haven't read this particular letter, so I think it's addressing the issue of the elderly, the nonprofit homes, elderly homes, as far as their the administrative and technical changes that were brought forth in 2208, as far as the amount of the way it is under current law is that you have the elderly rental assistance and the nonprofit elderly homes together in one appropriation each year or each biennium, and then the Department of Revenue, if for some reason the program payments come in higher than what they have an appropriation for, they will prorate the elderly rental assistance program payments, not the nonprofit elderly homes. And what we're changing in 2208 is we're allowing both programs to have proration. They would be sharing in that, and as well as allowing a proration in both years. And again, this was brought during the House side. Elizabeth Harchenko came and discussed this with the House Revenue Committee as far as what kind of changes could help them and being able to forecast and better distribute those appropriations to the two programs. And so one option that was discussed was prorating both programs. So I think that's that's somewhat around some of the concern that I've heard.
I think we, so what I'm hearing is that there was a discussion of this issue in the House consideration of the bill. And notwithstanding that consideration, Ms. Harchenko of the Revenue Department supported the version that we had before. Perhaps, even though we have not scheduled public testimony on this bill, perhaps we should hear from Ms. Neff briefly.
Mr. Chair, by the way, my interest was just make sure, since we brought so many bills back, that we didn't do something we didn't mean to.
Well, I share your concern, Senator. I think most of the citizens of the state would agree that even when we intend to do things, we shouldn't do them. So. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. I'll talk fast, but tell me if I'm talking so fast you can't understand me. My name is Lisa Neff. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Alliance Senior and Health Services, and we represent the nonprofit housing groups that would be affected by the amendments. This came in on the House amendments, and we weren't notified, or there were no discussions with us about how this would affect us. We've just found out about them a few days ago, and of course we'll take credit for not having known that that's the fact. So we scrambled to find out about the effect, and I would differ with the characterization of them being technical changes. It's a major policy change. Since 1977, nonprofit housing for the elderly has been a full exemption. And so this is a major policy change, and it seems to me like it's characterized as a technical fix. I've been talking with the Department of Revenue folks. Apparently the way the law is now, if enough money doesn't come in, this other elderly rental assistance has to pick up the tab. But to shift the tab onto the nonprofit housing for the elderly is, unless I'm misreading this, and I'd ask Elizabeth to clarify, it's no longer a full exemption now, and that's a major policy change. And that didn't go into the bill. The statute that the policy is in is ORS 307-241, which is the policy of the state to all benefits provided in nonprofit housing for the elderly. Then there's some other statutes that were changed in 2208, but it doesn't say that the state is changing its policy to fully fund the exemption. And so I just wanted to clarify that is my belief of what this bill does, and at least the committee ought to be clear, and maybe there ought to be a fuller discussion if we're going to reverse that 30-year policy. And I appreciate you making the exception to let me speak today.
Thank you, ma'am. The question I guess I have to ask is, your testimony that you are not certain that this is a reversal, or that you are certain that this is a reversal?
My belief is that it is a reversal, unless... as Revenue has explained it, unless I have misunderstood what they're doing. When I kind of asked, I thought the answer was, well, it still is a full exemption. Unless there's not enough money, then it's not a full exemption. So that sounds to me like it's not. The status now is that it's a full exemption, and this bill would change it to a partial exemption, which our concern is that our federal HUD Section 202 money requires a full exemption, and I asked Department of Revenue if they'd looked into that, and they weren't quite sure whether that legal question had been asked and answered. And I talked again with the Department of Revenue folks. We'd be happy to take a deeper look at it. One of my housing folks...
Perhaps an interim study for...
Task force.
Yeah.
One of my folks is on the phone right now to HUD to see if he can get a clarification, and if we were wrong about the impact on that, we'd be the first to admit it, but I do think it's a significant policy change to reverse the legislature's position of a full tax exemption for nonprofit housing for the elder, low-income housing.
And you have people checking even as we speak?
As we speak.
Perhaps you can stand down and we'll await that answer, but in the meantime, is there any clarification of folks from the
Mr. Chair, of course, Lisa. Would it help at all, I mean, to have legislative counsel speak to the issue in terms of the drafting? Is there a drafting change that concerns you?
Well, I'm not clarifying my letter, and I appreciate Senator Beyer having looked at it. My initial reading of the law was that it would go back to the local government. So maybe that was my mistake. If I understand now right, the intention is was not in the drafting, actually. So that answers your question. That the intention is to remove the full exemption, and that was, as I've written it here in the letter, was that was before I understood that. I thought that the Department of Revenue had misunderstood.
And so if I understand your question and the answer, Senator Corcoran, Department of Revenue has in fact put forward a policy change in this bill.
I believe so, although I understand that that would not have been their intention.
People from the Department of Revenue to come.
Well, I think you should have counsel too.
Yes, please.
Question, Senator Corcoran. Thank you.
Chairman Ferrioli.
There's a bit of confusion about what, and perhaps it's only the interpretation question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. The department came to the revenue committees with a problem, specifically the elderly rental assistance program and the nonprofit housing program are both funded with one appropriation. This last payment cycle, we sent out payments in October for the elderly rental assistance program and spent the entire amount for that program. And then we went to the emergency board and were given more funds in order to make additional payments for claims. We brought the issue to the legislature and asked what their policy preference would be in this matter if the appropriation for the next biennium is not enough to make payments in full for the elderly rental assistance claims and the nonprofit housing program claims that we expect to receive during the biennium. The appropriation, as I understand it, is $9 million. We expect that there will be claims that are greater than that. When we brought that to the House Revenue Committee, the House Revenue Committee decided as a policy matter that their preference would be to prorate both the elderly rental assistance program payments and the nonprofit housing program payments if the appropriation is not enough to fund the payments in their entirety. Current law only allows proration of the elderly rental assistance payments, not the nonprofit housing program payments. So what we would be required to do under current law, as I understand it, is in the first year of the biennium, we would pay out all of the elderly rental assistance claims that we receive, plus 100% of the nonprofit housing program payments that we receive. In the second year, we would then not have enough money based on our estimates. We would go ahead and pay 100% of the nonprofit housing programs and prorate only the elderly rental assistance program payments. So those payments would take the full hit of not having enough money in the appropriation to pay 100% of the claim. The House Revenue Committee chose to prorate both programs rather than only one. May I also add, Mr. Chair, as to the question of conflicts with the federal law, that question did come up in the House Revenue Committee. We did have the Attorney General's office look at that, and I believe they looked specifically at the statutes that are in page 12 of the A. Engrost version in section 22, and it's my recollection that they did not find any conflict with these particular statutes or these particular provisions in federal law and what we were what the House Revenue Committee had approved as far as proration. I don't have my notes on that with me, and I'd be happy to get that, but my recollection is that they did examine these particular sections of federal law and did not find a conflict. I'm looking on page 12 of the A. Engrost bill in section 22, lines 30 through 35, and it references various provisions of the U.S. Code. Mm. And if I just could make one more statement, we are not saying that these payments will absolutely be prorated. It's only if the claims that come in aren't enough the appropriation is not enough to pay the claims that do come in, both the elderly rental assistance and nonprofit housing programs would be prorated. Rather than this one. Thank you.
In other words, so there are several choices. The agency can go to the Legislative Emergency Board and ask for additional funding. If that were not to be available, then this bill would give the program the authority to sort of spread the misery equally among all the recipients of the relief, both the nonprofits and the individuals.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The other option that was considered by the committee was simply to fund the program with enough of a cushion that there would be no proration. But the money was not there, is my understanding.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Vice Chair. What's your estimate of the potential shortage?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byard, the last estimate that I know of is that it would be about $2 million short in the next biennium.
And what proportion is that?
The appropriation is $9 million, and we were expecting approximately $11 million in claims for both programs.
So about in the second year, you could be looking at about a 20%?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byard, if the proration only occurred in the second year, as it's written, we have the ability to spread the payments, spread the dollars between the 2 years of the biennium using our best estimates as to what will happen. Mm-hmm. Nonprofit housing will grow, perhaps elderly rental assistance will go down, so we look at that and try to spend all of the money as best we can. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I need a little bit more clarification about why there's a shortfall. Does expanding, increasing the maximum household income exacerbate there being enough funding for the people who previously qualified?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, the elderly rental assistance is not the same as the senior deferral program. The income limits on this one are different.
Okay.
These are renters. They are not property owners. They have to have $10,000 or less in household income. They have to be elderly people. There have been no changes in the requirements to participate in that program.
Okay. But to get back to my first part of my question.
As to why, Mr. Chair, as to why there is a shortage, it's simply that the amount appropriated by the legislature was not last year sufficient to pay all of the claims that came in under the program. In other words, there were more claims for assistance payments than had been appropriated to make the payments. And we ended up going to the emergency board to ask them whether they wanted us to go ahead and make additional payments, and they gave us the funding to do that.
And could you talk a little bit about who these people are that are applying for this help? Who are we helping through this program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, the ones under the Elderly Rental Assistance Program are elderly people, 58 or more, household income, $10,000 or less. That's all of the income of the household. That's not just taxable income, and who are also renting and paying property tax through their rent. So they're in a housing that is subject to property tax. Those are the general requirements for the program.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one program. But the other program is apparently for long-term care facilities, nonprofit.
Mr. Chair, the other program is for the nonprofit housing, and I am certainly not an expert on nonprofit housing. So we'll get someone up here who can answer that question.
Okay, I'll do it.
Oh gosh, we're built that we never expected to take public hearing on. We're certainly fearful. Good afternoon, ma'am.
Good afternoon. Chairman and committee, my name is Shirley Leeper for the record of Property Tax Division of Revenue. And in the nonprofit homes, they have to meet certain criteria. They have to be funded through HUD, et cetera. And there's an extensive process for that, but it is not like a long-term care facility necessarily. It can be like your short-term, go in, live there for a couple of years, move out if you choose to. They do not purchase the property. They grant paid monthly rent.
Question, Mr. Vice Chair.
Surely these are things like assisted living facilities?
Correct.
It could be nursing homes. Could be. Okay. So they're not just regular housing per se.
That's usually correct, I believe. Hmm.
Okay, well, what we have here is an $11 million request on a $9 million appropriation.
Exactly.
And an agreement by the Department of Revenue and the program administrators to look at potentially spreading the misery equally among the recipients, which seems roughly fair to me. But again, I would point out that just because the agency has created the strategy and asks for the authority to do that doesn't mean that they wouldn't also seek additional appropriations from the E-Board, if in fact we get to a place where there were shortfalls in that program. Yes, Ms. Christian.
Is the understanding, this was discussed in Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, it was. That was one of the suggestions, was that the appropriation be enough.
They didn't tell you, though, that you can't come back to the E-Board and ask for to make up the shortfall?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, no, they didn't.
My assumption was that you would come back and give the legislature the option to take care of any shortfall?
Senator Beyer, I'm sure we would do that, yes.
Okay. Was there a request for periodic updates on the status of the fund?
Mr. Chair, I don't recall that, but we'd be more than delighted to provide periodic updates.
More than delighted. I like that. Well, I certainly would request, as the chair of the Senate Revenue Committee, that you make periodic updates to the legislative revenue and legislative fiscal so that the staff of those agents or organizations, which also serve the legislative e-board, are aware and can continuously advise the members of the legislative e-board if there is a shortfall in funding shaping up. And I think that, given the fact that this was considered in Ways and Means, and given the fact that the appropriation was decided upon, and also given the fact that the Department of Revenue came up with a strategy for dealing with the shortfall that might be anticipated, I can't conclude otherwise than that people considered what the effect of this policy change would be. So.
So it's ready to move.
I think I'm ready to see it. Move. We have a couple of other things we need to do to the bill, but at least in terms of the issue that was raised about public housing, about nonprofit housing, I think that is timely, important. I think the committee's put adequate discussion on the record that would lead anybody to conclude that it intends to have a continuous assessment of the funding stream available, and if there is a shortfall, that the Ways and Means sub or appropriate sub in that Ways and Means goal would be advised. And I think better than that, I don't know what we can do other than that. I don't think we send this bill back to the Ways and Means Committee for further consideration. I think we move the bill forward. At least, Senator Beyer, thank you for bringing the issue to our attention. I don't think there's anything more that we need to do to consider that aspect of the bill. There is, however, Mr. Yates, another issue that I think we need to touch upon, and that is we need to look at the fiscal implications of the A13 issue.
Okay.
And then when Senator Corcoran returns, I need to talk to him about a procedural faux pas that we made mistaken reliance on Mr. Yates' pronouncement that we have to have without objection. It is a simple majority. We need to take that vote again. But Mr. Yates, let's talk about the fiscal impacts of the A13 amendment.
Revenue impacts.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. In fact, even revenue.
You should have three pages in the materials that were given to you on the bill, which the first page, they're stapled, and the first page is headed HB 228-13, revenue impact.
Can it generate that much money, not three pages worth?
That's right. if you may recall, last time I was, when you first considered this amendment, I was rather unprepared since it was handed to me and I was told to walk in and talk to you about it.
And I thought you did a masterful job.
Anyway, since then, I've had a chance to look at the bill. And what I did, first of all, you know, to fully analyze such an approach would take a rather exhaustive sort of analysis. But to begin with, I just took the proponent's numbers, essentially. And on the first page there, what you have is OLCC's annual revenue from the sale of these low-proof beverages, which is distilled liquor or spirits containing alcohol less than 14%. The number's $2,104,000 for a year based on 77,142 gallons sold. This gives you a revenue per gallon of $27.28, And for these products, OLCC has a 116% markup, okay? So the rest of these numbers follow out mathematically in terms of what it costs them is $12.63 per gallon, and the markup is $14.65 per gallon. You take out the costs for the liquor agents who sell the product, and I put in $1.40 per case cost of delivering it from the OLCC warehouse to the various agent stores. And you come up with a revenue to the state, which is available for distribution to the general fund, cities, counties, and so on, of $11.70 per gallon. Now, the proponent said that based on Virginia experience in the last state which did this, which was Virginia, which I believe was in 95, the volume of these products sold through the state stores would decline to 75, decline by 25%, essentially, to 75%. So you see a fall in the numbers here from 77,000 gallons to 57,857,000 gallons. And their experience in Virginia in terms of the total sales of these products, based on some advertising program and so on that they did and they would expect to do here, and if it were comparable, they would expect the private sales, i.e. through grocery stores and other outlets, to be about 313 gallons. So you've got a total there of about almost a 400% increase in the volume of these products sold. Now, what you get for each gallon that's sold privately is 67 cents, compared with the $11.70 for each gallon that goes through the state store. Okay, so you're getting a lot less per gallon, but you get a lot more gallons sold. Now, they did not make any adjustment there for the fact that probably the major substitute for these products is beer, or at least malt beverages. And so we already get a tax on those. So what I've done is to sort of hypothetically say, where do these sales come from, this volume of sales, 313 million, which is going to go through private stores. And I said 90% of that is going to be a reduction in beer sales or malt beverage sales. 5% would be something that's not taxed. In other words, these products through advertising become attractive relative to sandwiches or something that isn't subject to the liquor tax. 4% would replace table wines, 1% dessert wines such as vermouth. Given those assumptions, then you get, again, for the reduced sales through the state stores, they drop from 900,000 to 676,000. The tax at 67 cents per gallon distributed through grocery stores would raise 209,000, and then you lose 23,000 in malt beverage tax, 8,000 in wine tax, and another 2,000 in the dessert wine tax, for a total of 852,000, a net revenue impact of a minus 50,000.
I just did it because you weren't here.
And if you look at the very bottom, what you end up with there is, my estimate, a substantially different price for the same product, whether you buy it in a state store or in a grocery store. If OLCC were to continue its same markup policy, that product would cost $27.28 per gallon in the state stores, and my estimate of the private sector price is $20.75, so it's about 31% higher in the state store. And the second page then is exactly the same type of analysis, almost hypothetically done for the state of Virginia. Okay, because that's the model that they use to determine how volume is going to be affected. So what I held constant was the number of gallons sold, which is 77,000. Now, 1995, Virginia only had a 75% markup as opposed to our 116%. So they get a lot less. They get about $7.63 per gallon of money available for the state government, as opposed to our $11.70. You follow through the example with the same assumptions, and you come down to the revenue that comes in under the proposal, and you see it's a lot higher for the articles that are being sold there because of the low proof volume, because Virginia's tax is $1.51 per gallon, not 67 cents per gallon. Okay. So, in fact, you do find, for the example here, to the extent that I, you know, can sort of estimate what really happened in Virginia, you do find that they found a lot of revenue by doing this, and you'd expect that. And, in fact, you also find that the price is almost the same whether you buy the product through a state store or through a grocery store. Okay. But my concern here is the price differential is going to cause a lot of shift away from OLCC state liquor stores into the grocery store. So you're really going to go to a liquor store to pay 31% more for the same product. So I think the Virginia example is not a good example. So the third page is kind of a worst-case scenario. Maybe not worst-case, but certainly also I think maybe more realistic. And what I've done there, the only real change is to go back again to the Oregon model, but assume that OLCC sales decline by 90% rather than 25%. So the gallons go from 77,000 down to 7,000. And again, continuing through this, you end up with a loss, a revenue loss of $608,000 per year. And if you wanted a tax rate to be revenue neutral, that would be $2.34 for this example. On the first page, I forgot to mention a revenue neutral tax rate would be 83 cents rather than the 67 cents. So it's probably reality somewhere between the two.
Mr. Yates, what you're suggesting is that as the bill's currently constructed, this is revenue negative.
Yes.
You can't have that.
The size of that, however, is not altogether easily determined.
Chairman.
Senator Miss.
I move that we remove the A13 amendment from House Bill 2208.
Thank you, Senator Miss. We have already had that motion, and the chairman was advised we needed a simple majority of those present would be quite sufficient. We have a motion on the floor. The clerk will call the roll.
You still need to suspend the rules.
No, we don't. No, we do not. We just got it from the parliamentarian. You can go argue with her if you want. It's 20 minutes till 5. Go argue.
I give up. Mr. Yates, we had a delivery from she who must not be denied. City Hall, the Senate Secretary. And that was a clarification that we sought. And I would have followed you into hell on that motion, Dick. That didn't work. Yes, sir.
Dick, I'm trying to follow you here. So, we, as the amendment, as the bill stands now, we have it in there, and we imposed a 67-cent tax?
Yes.
And what would that tax have to be revenue neutral?
According to the first page of estimates here, if you assume the Virginia model applies, then the revenue neutral tax would be 83 cents per gallon. Now, I think that there's going to be more elasticity, if you like, or that the shift in sales between the state stores and the grocery stores is going to be larger in Oregon than the Virginia experience. So I think the revenue neutral number, think for a moment about what you're getting. You're getting $11.70 for every gallon that moves through the state store. You're getting 67 cents for every gallon that moves through the grocery store. Okay, so if there's a price differential, people are going to tend to shift their purchases from state stores to grocery stores. The bigger that shift, the less money you're going to get. Comprendo?
I understand what you're saying. I'm just having a hard time agreeing with it. My sense is people walk down to the aisle of the Albertsons and they decide which bottle of lemonade they're going to pick up. I don't think the same. The people who go into a state liquor store aren't looking for a bottle of lemonade. They're looking for a bottle of hard liquor. It's a very different consumer. It's one of the reasons why we have beer and wine separated from the hard liquor stores. You don't, those consumers of that beverage aren't in the hard liquor store. So I would suggest, at least in my mind, I would think you're going to lose very little sale through the liquor store. What you may lose is a substitution in the grocery store.
That's true.
Senator Corbin.
I don't think that's speaking to the motion.
Excuse me?
I don't think this is speaking to the motion.
Oh, it was a clarification question about revenue. And since that was the line you followed,
the motion.
Senator?
I would argue that it is. I think the point that the senator made in the motion was because it's revenue loss, that we should take it out of the bill. What I was arguing was that I don't think it necessarily as constructed, maybe, but it doesn't have to be a revenue loss.
Mr. Chair, since I was the one that raised the objection, I think the reason for the motion is not revenue loss. The reason for the motion has to do with adding additional alcoholic beverages in grocery stores.
Let's get to the bottom of the reason for the motion. Senator Minnis, to your motion.
Well, I'm a little disheartened to some extent, even with myself, by having voted for this amendment in the first place. Because I think, unfortunately, as it was originally presented to me, I was under the impression there was little opposition. I have subsequently found out that that, in fact, is not true. I do know that there is at least intent, from what I understand, on the part of the governor to conduct a study on these issues by executive order, if not by virtue of a bill that the revenue committee's had. So, to me, the issue is extremely complex. And something that I'm unwilling to just simply vote for without having some in-depth discussion and research on before I'm willing to step over that bridge. And I'm that comfortable with it.
Senator Minnis, I have been hearing from Mr. Lazenby rumors of an executive order. It's like sightings of the great white whale. You know? It raises and spouts and then it disappears. I'd love to see the executive order. I've asked for Mr. Lazenby to bring forth the executive order in draft form that the governor would sign. Perhaps Senate Bill 935 goes away. Perhaps some other...
is that the great lemonade or...
Well, actually, there's a lot of folks out there that if there is to be an executive order, let's put it on paper and get it out there where people can see it.
Just, I guess, in closing, if this issue was brought to us at the beginning of the session, and we had an opportunity to root out all of these things and do the research, I may be more comfortable, but I'm just not at this point.
Other considerations on the motion, questions, comments? Call roll, please.
No.
Aye.
We are required to vote, too, aren't we?
Yeah.
I'll vote aye.
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 No? No. I believe that motion passes, if I got the count right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran?
Do we need to do any further amendments?
I'm
concerned about the issues raised by the housing activists that we need to address that because we don't want to. Part of the reason for this strategy of removing this Dash 13 was that the bill was in fact very important for a large constituency, and so there were some alarms raised. I know that revenue addressed those. I was curious if the responses were adequate to the concerns, and I don't see Mr. Nuss in here.
You know, I will say that I know that issue was raised in revenue considerations on the House side. Ways and Means, I think, must have been consulted on the appropriation of the $9 million. They were advised of the $11 million assumption of need, and what we got was the bill as you see it. So, unless we're interested in second-guessing folks all the way back up the line on this consideration.
Yeah.
I guess the only thing we would do is, refer it back to Ways and Means and say, hey, you left out the $2 million.
Well, Mr. Chair, in that case, then I would move the bill to the floor, and then I guess we still have the time between now and the bill being heard on the floor, but if we found new information that we could move it
pull the bill back.
Yeah.
That would be one approach. I guess I could speculate on the prospects of reopening this committee. I think maybe, you know, my present experience tells me I don't want to do that again.
We could send it to the Clinton Committee, Public Affairs.
However, the problem for me is people are running to catch these bills, and Ms. caught me with a note off the Senate floor today.
Yeah. Well, let's just move it then.
And then trying to figure out whether or not to consider that issue legitimate. You know, I'm sure everyone has the same level of concern. question is now, what, you know, now what do we do? Run back to the House Revenue and ask them.
I'll table the bill and we'll be done with it.
No, the housing folks need it.
Well, it is an important bill. So
the table the bill, they'll come out of the woodwork.
Mr. Chair, the bill is amended to the floor with DuPass recommendation.
Let me ask that the motion was made to table the bill, so let's just hold our water.
I thought that was a what if.
Mm-hmm. That was a
rhetorical.
We can do that informally by simply dropping the gavel and asking Ways and Means whether or not they have fully considered the implications.
Move it to the floor. Be done with it.
Chair, we are in work session.
For the third time, Mr. Chair.
Is that a motion I heard?
Yeah.
So moved.
Now, before we accept the motion, as part of the discussion, I will ask Ms. Hall, who unquestionably has spies in every room in this building, if not watching the monitor, and hope she is, or Kim, who protects us from our own procedural stupidities, or any other member of the staff who's anything that we've done that would cause us to have to reconsider the vote on this bill yet a third time.
And Dick, don't you say it.
You wouldn't believe me anyway. Senator George.
Do we have all appropriate other amendments in this thing?
I simply asked all staff to know of any other appropriate amendments.
Let's not troll for any.
Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
No. The ayes have it. The bill moves to the floor of the DuPass recommendation. I need a carrier for this wonderful bill. They're pointing at each other. Corcoran, would you like to carry this?
Senator Madison and I will carry it together.
The Corcoran Venice team. Actually, I would rather select one or the other of you. Senator Corcoran, have you carried even one bill for the
board? I carried a banking bill and business and labor, and since you won't hear my deregulation bill.
Are we done?
You want to help me, Dick? You come and sit at my chair. Yeah, you come and sit at my chair when I carry this bill.
We did not have a full complement of members on the consideration of Senate Bill 67, so we are in work session on Senate Bill 67.
You have a motion on the floor. Did you close with a motion on the floor?
Yeah. The chair will accept a motion to move Senate Bill 67 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Parliamentary inquiry.
Inquire away, sir. We have experts surrounding the bill.
If you have a motion on the floor, then
we had a vote.
No,
we had
no.
A vote.
No,
oh, no, we didn't.
It was before
we
didn't
vote.
And the motion was what?
We had an informal constitutional problem, and we did not have, I don't think we had a motion.
Okay. All right, I move Senate Bill 67 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
And that
I
is.
Moved it. And we
right.
Closed.
Yeah. Right. And I believe now before you move this bill or not move this bill, does it include the dash 3 amendments?
Yes,
yes, it does. Clerk will call the roll.
No. No.
No.
George.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye. Motion passes. Chair will carry.
Aye.
As the vice chairman has adjourned the meeting, we are in adjournment.